IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. Today I have with me our guest on the show and my colleague at Takshashila, Pranay Kotasthane. Welcome on the show, Pranay.
Thanks, Shri.
In the past, we have heard a lot about cooperative federalism. I remember when GST kicked off in 2017, cooperative federalism was the talk of the town and the buzzword we heard everywhere from policy commentators. Even the meetings of GST Council, at least in the initial phases, represented the spirit of cooperativism. All decisions were taken by consensus. And today, despite some of the problems in state finances caused by the pandemic, the GST Council still, by and large, has maintained and sustained this spirit of cooperative federalism over the year. However, today, what we are going to talk about is a different form of federalism, or it can also be seen as an extension of cooperative federalism. And this is something known as competitive federalism. The idea here is that states compete against each other to woo investors and attract investment in their respective states, and the best state wins the prize. So a few months back, I remember Elon Musk had tweeted that Tesla is facing challenges in coming to India and that they're still working on it. At this point, the industry's minister from Telangana jumped in and tweeted that, you know, our state is the champion in sustainability initiatives and a top-notch business destination in India, so Tesla should come to Telangana. After this, the minister from West Bengal jumped in and said, Bengal means business, so Tesla should come to Bengal. And similarly, politicians and ministers from Maharashtra, Punjab and Tamil Nadu started tweeting to Elon Musk and did their own sales pitch on Twitter. And this entire, you know, display of competition between the states for attracting Tesla's investment happened on Twitter. So Pranay, I want to begin by asking you, is this what is meant by competitive federalism or is there more to it?
Yeah, so I think to learn what exactly competitive federalism is, we have to go to public finance literature and study there. So a lot of work has been done in that area. But before we go there, just a few other instances where we've seen this operate in recent times, right? One is the Vedanta Foxconn MOU, which was signed with the government of Gujarat. There was a lot of tussle between Maharashtra and Gujarat over this particular project. And we saw that playing out over the last few weeks. Then also Rajasthan first sort of went back on the pension reforms that took place in 2004. And then now there is even talk that Punjab government might go back, you know. So there is this idea that if this state has done it, I also need to do the same. And finally, we always see some kinds of subsidies, sometimes non-merit subsidies, which one state brings in and other states compete to bring in similar kinds of subsidies, right? So these are some different kinds of ways in which competitive federalism operates. Now, competitive federalism is quite a natural state of things, I would say, in the sense that there are different entities within the union. And these entities called states can compete with each other. In fact, the sum of this competition is much desired, right? So if they are competing in order to win businesses, win over investments, probably competing on better healthcare conditions or better infrastructure, it is all desirable, right? In fact, in the last Independence Day speech, if I'm not wrong, the Prime Minister also mentioned that, right? That it is the need of the hour that besides cooperative federalism, we also need competitive federalism. So some sort of it is desirable, but we need to investigate this deeper, right? Like, why is it that we are in a situation where states are competing, but they are not competing for things like, you know, better law and order situation? None of these states said that we have the best law and order situation, right? Or we have the best welfare situation, etc. They were competing on one, either we are giving great tax breaks, so please come here, or they are competing for things which are non-meritorious, right? Or things which are actually, you can say they are taking India into a worse off direction, like going back on pension reforms. So it's interesting to understand what is competitive federalism, under which conditions is it desirable, and where it is not desirable. What do you think?
That is true. By what you mentioned, I think that broadly, very broadly speaking, there are two kinds of competitive federalism, right? Let's just call it good and bad. And from the examples that you've spoken of, it seems that, you know, our states are indulging in competitive federalism of the bad kind. Right. And another example that I could think of is how there is competition for jobs among different states. And some states have also opted to bring in a certain domicile laws, which say that even in private sector, certain amount of jobs will be reserved to the people who have domiciled in that particular state. So this is the kind of competition that we are witnessing between the states, and not a more positive or the good kind of it, where, you know, you talk about infrastructure, you talk about the demographic talent, you talk about maybe an easy immigration policy, which enables everybody to come and relocate very easily to your place and so on and so forth. So how do we make this happen, Pranay?
Yeah, the example you gave is a good one. And some of these bad ideas seem to catch everyone's attention, right? And other states also start having these local reservation policies and all that. By the way, this competitive federalism word is so complicated to pronounce. I think we'll just refer to it as CF. Otherwise, I'll keep saying it incorrectly. But anyways, so let's go ahead. So what I was thinking is, I tried to investigate what this term actually means and where did it come from. Right. So this term itself, as I said, comes from public finance literature. And there's a seminal paper on this by Albert Breton. It's a paper from 1987 called Towards a Theory of Competitive Federalism. So that is a nice approach where he's trying to investigate what it actually means. Right. And he's coming at this from the lens of Canada, again, a federal setup, where there are conditions similar to India in the sense there are many states, there are different ethnicities, there are also French people, there are also the English people, and there is competition amongst various states on various counts, right? So Albert Breton was writing in that context and trying to understand, you know, how should we understand competitive federalism. So from that literature, we understand that, you know, he says there are two conditions under which competitive federalism can be efficient. So the first condition is called competitive equality. No, so what it necessarily means is similar to what we talk about in the case of, you know, equality of opportunity or equality of outcome, those debates, right? So we say that how just we need affirmative action because individuals from disadvantaged communities need some support in order to even compete with others, right? So that's the necessary condition that you have to establish beforehand in order to ensure efficient competition, right? So healthy competition between states also requires not just good umpiring, but also progressive rule making, you know, in the sense that it tries to put states at similar disadvantage or a similar advantage. So on an equal footing, how can different states of different sizes and different advantages be brought about? That is what is known as competitive equality. So Breton had a very nice statement around it, which I wanted to just discuss. So I'll just read it out from my notes. What he says is that horizontal competition does not require that all competing units be of equal size any more than efficient competition in markets requires that firms be of equal size. But it must be that the large units are not in a position to continually dominate, coerce, and in other ways prevent the smaller units from making independent, autonomous decisions. Nor are they in a position to inflict disproportionate damage on them. The smaller units must be able to compete with the strong on an equal footing. So this is what competitive equality essentially means, you know. So you are trying to bring states of different per capita incomes, different situations broadly at the same level so that competition can take place fairly. And crucially, what he says is that the responsibility for ensuring competitive equality actually lies with the union government. So in this sense, it is the responsibility of the union government not just to umpire between the states, but also to ensure that a progressive rulemaking takes place. And how can union governments do that? There are broadly two mechanisms. One is intergovernmental grants. So these are the grants which the union government does through the centrally sponsored schemes. And also constitutionally, there is something called the Finance Commission, which tries to give intergovernmental grants. So there are two types of grants. One is specific grants, which are given for specific purposes. And there are general purpose grants, which are basically cash transfers to state governments to do anything as they wish according to their priorities. authority. So with these mechanisms, there is a purpose, right? The purpose is to ensure that there is competitive equality, that certain states which are disadvantaged in one or the other way, they in over time are able to reduce this gap which has emerged, right? That's why this intergovernmental grant exists. So this is one mechanism. The other one is, of course, a council of states, which we call the Rajya Sabha. And that is also responsible to give salience to the requirements and the needs of different state governments, right? That's why that institution exists in the first place. So those are two mechanisms which can be used for competitive equality. What do you think about this, Sri?
Yeah, before commenting on the suggestions, the two suggestions of intergovernmental grants and Council of States made by Breton, I would like to point out that, you know, regional disparity was always a problem in India. Our country is a diverse federal nation and we have states which have different geographical terrains, states which are far off, states which are tribal dominated, hilly states, remote areas, all kinds of things. So our states were probably never on equal footing to begin with. And even today we see, you know, there's a distinction in terms of development between the northern states and the southern states, between the western states and the eastern states and so on. So it is very important for a nation like India to establish an equal footing before, you know, competitive federalism or CF can kick off in a true and fair sense. So however, this is also, I think, from what I recall, has led the government to make certain undesirable policy intervention. And one of them was, you know, these freight equalization charges, which was imposed by the government for ferrying raw materials on trains. And the idea was, you know, to ensure that industries crop up in all parts of the state and not just where raw materials or minerals are available or near ports. The government would charge extra for transportation of raw materials, if I'm correct. And this actually led to deindustrialization in many states. And you also have curious cases of, you know, having an oil refinery in central India, in North India, in Mathura and some places like that. Hmm. So I would guess that is a bad example of a government intervention, which I try to create an equal footing.
Yeah, so the crucial difference in that was the way this policy was trying to correct for the disadvantages, right? So it is trying to say that, you know, these kinds of businesses, industries which require the raw materials could be established theoretically in any part of India. That's the assumption behind it. But that's obviously not true, right? There are certain states which will have certain advantages and certain other states will have different comparative advantages, right? So it would be very silly to expect that IT industry should take off in every state in India. That's not possible. I mean, even in Karnataka, it is not possible that what we have in Bangalore will be there in every other city in the state itself, right? There are comparative advantages which develop over time and due to various reasons. So the idea should have been rather to first see what is the cause of those differences and to help states to at least identify their own comparative advantages and put money where they think it is important, you know. So there might be certain states which would have tried to take a different path to industrialization, not look at the raw materials through mines, coals, when this policy was brought about, right? They might not want a steel industry, but they might want to look at, say, textiles or other things, right? So such things are crucial to identify. Better policies to give these grants to the state governments and let them decide where it should be used, rather than these kinds of policies which are trying to sort of bring about regional development by predetermining what should be there in all states.
Yeah, I think that was one of the pitfalls of the top-down decision making that we had in the early stages of India's economic growth. In any case, on the two points of intergovernmental grants and Council of States, don't you think in India, in any case, the states which are larger, which have more population and which have more financial clout already sort of dominate this, in the sense the contribution from taxes is higher from these developed and well-to-do states. The money that they receive from the center, their share is also higher. Similarly, our Council of Rajya Sabha is based on proportional representation of states on the basis of their population size. Unlike, say, the US Senate, where, you know, all states are equal in the Senate. Everybody has two senators and there are 100 in total. So do you think these shortcomings will have a role in the way India's competitive federalism will pan out?
No, yeah, definitely there are lots of gaps here, right? So there are lots of reforms needed to improve competitive equality. First of all, our design of intergovernmental transfer which should actually help bridge the gap between states so that there is a level playing field, doesn't happen, you know. So in fact, what happens is we had this planning commission earlier, and planning commission, the plans, like you were mentioning, were decided by the union government. And according to the union government's priorities, the union government also had the mechanism to distribute money to the different states, right? So, and it was tied to the plan which was formed by the union government, right? So there is less of competitive equality in this situation itself, right? Not just horizontal, but even there's vertical inequality in the sense that union government decides what is important. So that was one problem. And even in current intergovernmental grants, we know that some of these are regressive, in the sense that even though you, let's say health, right? So you would want public health situation or IMR to go down in all parts of India, right? Even if it's not a question of we being okay that it's all right in one part of India and not in another. But if you look at the analysis of the intergovernmental transfers, they are regressive in the sense that they, lesser money is given to the states which actually require more on a per capita basis, whereas more money goes to states which don't need it, you know. So there are either the reasons are that states want this money because the union government is promising it under a centrally sponsored scheme, so who wants to let go of extra money which comes in. And so we have this situation where our intergovernmental transfers actually don't work efficiently. They are not working towards reducing competitive equality, and the gap between the states just continues, you know. So there are both things. So one, you would actually need more general purpose grants to all states, whether rich or poor. But to certain states, when we're talking about specific purpose transfers, like, you know, health, law and order, education, I would say we are not doing well there. And we need to even go further, investigate that and get the states which are worse off in some of these very critical areas, especially these areas, there are interstate externalities, right? So public health situation in one state can also become a public health situation in another, right? So it's important for us to investigate those and help those states overcome that situation. So that's one thing I would say about intergovernmental transfers. I think 14th Finance Commission has repeatedly mentioned that, you know, we need actually an institution which can allow union government and state governments to bargain and negotiate. And unless that kind of institution comes in, this we'll have more competition and less cooperation. So that is one. On Council of States, Shri, we know, right, like Rajya Sabha barely represents state interest. Now, Rajya Sabha also has become an institution which is dominated by political parties. And because of the anti-defection law in 1985, it's most of the issues that come up are from the lens of a political party rather than from the lens of the states, right? So again, there is a lot of reform to be done there. Reforms on who gets into the Rajya Sabha, for example. Currently, people who are not even resident in that state after showing some address proof for a certain period can become a Rajya Sabha member from there, right? So there are such things which actually make it a less effective organization for ensuring competitive equality. So we need reforms there.
So speaking of, yeah, that's true with Rajya Sabha, and I don't know when this reforms are even going to come because it has actually become a system of political rewards. You know, if a person loses an election for Lok Sabha and does not have a rehabilitative place, they are usually sent to Rajya Sabha and so on. But those political problems aside, you mentioned that, you know, there should be a mechanism where we identify which states are in dire need of finance and they should be provided an adequate level of funding from the central government. However, this also poses a problem of moral hazard, right? And now we have certain states in India which are overexposed to debt and they are actually in need of more funding and support. So is there a contradiction here?
No, there is no contradiction in the sense what I said. One, you need to ensure specific purpose transfers in very limited areas, right? So like I said, you have to identify areas in the sense subjects which are meritorious, subjects which have interstate externalities, which will be very few in number, you know. So you would say health, law and order, probably education, and that's all, right? Those are the areas where you would actually want all states to prosper, and states which are worse off need to be helped. But at an overall level, what we need to do is the second condition that Breton comes to, which is cost-benefit appropriability. So what it means is basically that states should be regulated by a hard budget constraint. You know, so that is their, the consequences of states breaching spending limits should be a significant one. And that should be same even if the state is rich or poor, right? So what it means is the moral hazard develops if the states assess that, you know, union government will bail them out in case there is a fiscal failure. And if that happens, then you will have a situation where states will continue to spend as they want, not bothering about who is going to bear the expenses of their failures, right? So on the other case, if there's a hard budget constraint, so if a state breaches certain situation norms of good finance, then they need to bear the consequences of these, you know. So this is a necessary condition which will ensure that the kind of situation you are saying would not happen. Okay. So again, if we see in India, competitive federalism often takes place in a situation where cost-benefit appropriability doesn't exist, you know. So what happens is that there's no hard budget constraints, states can still go on spending over and above the limit, and that leads to a situation where you end up passing the burden to another state, right? So you will give loan waivers knowing fully well that either the union government will bail you out, which means some other states and some other people from other states are paying for that money, right? There's nothing which comes for free. So this is one way in which, if we don't pay attention to it, competitive federalism will be inefficient.
And I think since you spoke about budget constraint, hard budget constraints on states so that, you know, they have an eye on their spending and do not overexceed their budgets every single year, there is a provision of law, right? Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act, or FRBM, which poses certain conditions for states to follow when it comes to managing their fiscal deficit. And this is usually set as a percentage of fiscal deficit. However, I think the problem, Pranay, here is these are soft targets. Has there been any movement in this regard?
Yeah, so fiscal deficit is represented as a percentage of the state GDP. So yeah, then generally you have 3%, etc. So FRBM was a reform which brought the states in and at least put this target, and states were given some grants, etc., in order to come on board for this reform. So in that sense, it was cooperative federalism in practice. But what has happened is that there is no punishment for a state which does not follow it. You know, there is nothing in the FRBM Act which is actually imposes a hard budget constraint in reality. And the second most important part is that the union government itself has been guilty of not following a hard budget constraint, you know. So if the umpire itself is cheating, how can you expect the players to not cheat, right? So that's a bigger problem here, that union governments themselves have kept breaching their FRBM targets. So state governments just learn what union government has done, right? So that is one thing. The union government really has a big responsibility to set an example here. That is something which needs to be done. And second, there is also something called the Independent Fiscal Council. So this Independent Fiscal Council is a reform which has been talked about in many finance commissions now. And what it does is that it does an ex ante evaluation of the costs of government proposals. For instance, you saw this Maharashtra and Gujarat government promising subsidies worth 40,000 crores and 28,000 crores respectively for this semiconductor and display fab plant, right? But we don't have any public scrutiny of the costs and benefits of the project, right? Like, we don't know how much returns are going to be come out of this kind of subsidies, etc. So an independent fiscal council would have come of use here. It would have conducted an independent fiscal evaluation of such policies before they receive final approval. You know, so if this is put in place, then we will at least have a better visibility of what the state governments are spending on. And eventually there will be debate on what is the benefit that comes out of it, etc. And I'm hoping that will lead us to a situation where we think more in terms of hard budget constraints than we do so now.
Yeah, like they say, if, you know, if the police is watching you, who is watching the police? I think that sort of represents the situation the union government is in when it comes to maintaining its fiscal targets. So we have spoken about the two conditions suggested by Breton for competitive federalism to exist, right? The first is competitive equality, and the second is the cost-benefit appropriability. So is this it, or are there more conditions that need to be satisfied?
Yeah, so there is another third precondition that I came across. This is from a paper Fiscal Decentralization in Indian Federalism by Dr. Govind Rao, who is also a counselor of the Takshashila Institution. So Dr. Rao had written that the third condition is there should be no impediments to the unrestricted mobility of factors and products outside the country. So what it essentially means is that states should not be able to, you know, restrict mobility of people coming in and out. That should be the third condition. This is similar to what you said, Sri, about labor, you know, reservation for local labor. That violates this kind of condition. And when that happens, again, you have unhealthy competitive federalism, because what states can then do is they can impose taxes on things which are coming into the state from other states. And so the costs are passed on to others and the benefits are cornered by people who are quote unquote domiciled, right? So this is again, it violates sort of the cost benefit appropriability principle also. And it also leads to a situation where the entire Indian Union is not one market, right? Then it becomes 29, 30 different markets. And then you don't have the advantage of scale, which country like India must definitely enjoy. And it will be a lot of benefit if we have one common market. That's why GST was also brought in. But if we have this restricted mobility of factors and products, we will be in a situation where competitive federalism will be unhealthy.
Yeah, that's true. And these are not something new to us, right? Like, In fact, your right to move to any place within the country and your right to settle in any place in the country, your right to practice any profession, trade or occupation, these are all codified as fundamental rights in our constitution. Mm. And somehow the states, for their own parochial reasons, have been, you know, at this game of curtailing these rights one by one in the name of domicile quota, in the name of the outer migrant and economic jobs and so on. But these battles should have been won a long time ago, but they have come back, I think, in the recent times. I don't know what the reason could be. Could you hazard a guess? What could be the reasons? Why is this happening more?
No, because first of all, in the constitution itself, there are exceptions to this fundamental right. And many states have expanded that exception to mean not just government jobs, but now also to some states are also talking about private sector jobs, etc. So that's sort of one baked in reason why this is happening. And over time, why this is also expanding is just because if the economy doesn't do well, there are less jobs produced. And since there are less jobs, there is more competition for those jobs. And when you are not going to get a job, you are going to seek the state's help in all fair, unfair ways, right? And that's what is happening now. Because of the decade of slow economic growth, there is this situation where people want jobs they don't have and they find an easier target by identifying the quote-unquote outsider as the reason for this, right? And that's what happens in all countries. It's happening in India as well. So that's why I guess the sudden demand for these kinds of changes now. The third reason also is just that there is a wide difference between what people earn in the government and what people perceive that they learn outside, right? And especially in the government, the kind of salaries that people earn, the pensions that people earn, that is seen as something very highly desirable even today compared to an employment outside. And this gap also makes people aspire for a government job more. And if government job, they aspire more and they don't get it, then these kinds of domicile requirements keep coming to the fore again and again.
Yeah, like you said, however, competitive federalism is supposedly the natural state of things and it is desirable to a great extent. But we seem to have gone down the wrong path, the path of bad CF as opposed to good CF. However, we do hope, I mean, there is, I think, from whatever you have said, it looks encouraging. I think there is a lot of scope for course correction here. And we definitely can enshrine in a true spirit of competitive federalism, which leads to healthy competition between the states and also more equitable and beneficial competition for everyone involved. Thank you, Pranay, for being on the podcast with me today.
Thanks, Sri.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. or our website, takshashila.org.in.